Track 14.
He is a traitor. Allah is my witness. He has sold us into slavery, one of the sheikhs said. They growled like a pride of lions and looked to Al-Malik. He is my brother and my caliph, said the prince. I am oath-bound to him. By God, he is no longer a ruler of Oman, a sheikh protested. He has become the plaything of the port. He who has sodomized 1,000 boys has become the bum-whore of the Turks, agreed another. By his treachery, you and all of us are released from our vows of fealty. Lead us, mighty lord, urged another. We are your men. Lead us to the gates of Muscat, and we will help you drive out the Ottoman, place you on the elephant throne of Oman. One after another they spoke, and all said the same thing. We have pleaded to you to come to us. Now we plead for you to lead us. We, the Tsar, are your oathmen. We can raise 3,000 lances to ride at your back. What of the other tribes? The prince asked, not rushing into such a dire decision. What of the Awamir and the Bayit Imani? What of the Bayit Katir and the Harassis? We of the Tsar cannot speak for them, they answered, for there are blood feuds between us and many of them. But their sheikhs wait for you in the sands. Go to them, and God willing they will raise the war lance and ride with us to Muscat. Give us your decision, they begged. Give us your decision, and we will give you our oath. I will lead you, said the prince softly and simply, and their weathered brown faces lit with joy. One by one they knelt before him and kissed his feet. When he held out his curved dagger, they touched the steel with their lips. Then they took his hands, lifted the prince to his feet, and led him out of the tent to where the warriors waited in the moonlight. We give you the new Caliph of Oman, they told their men, who shouted their allegiance and fired their muskets into the air. The war drums began to beat, and the eerie blast of the ram's horns echoed from the dark cliffs above the grove. In the joyous commotion, Dorian came to his father and embraced him. I and my men are ready to take you to meet the sheikhs of the Awamir at the wells of Mukhaid. Then let us ride, my son, the prince agreed. Dorian left him and strode away through the grove, calling to his men. Saddle up! We ride at once! They ran to their camels, calling them by name, and soon the entire valley was in uproar as they broke camp. The camels bellowed and roared as they were loaded with their leather waterskins, and the tents were collapsed and packed. Before the rise of the new moon, in the cool of the night, they were ready to ride, a long column of robed, veiled men on their tall beasts. The prince's camel was a creamy yellow female. When he had seated himself on the saddle, Dorian commanded her to rise. With a groan, she lurched to her feet. Al-Malik sat her easily. Born in the desert and a warrior from boyhood, he made a noble picture in the first rays of the rising moon. Dorian sent a vanguard of 20 men ahead and a rearguard to come up behind. He rode close beside the prince as the column started up the valley and headed out into the desert. They went swiftly, all racing camels, and but for the water skins, lightly burdened. They climbed up and out of the valley, and the desert stretched ahead, infinite and still, purple and dark hills of rock and shining dunes of silver sand stretching away to the north. Above the winding serpent of men and beasts, the stars were a dazzling field, like banks of wild white daisies after rain. The sand muted the fall of the camel's broad pads, and the only sound was the creak of leather and the occasional soft murmur of a voice warning, "Beware! Hold!" Dorian rode at ease, lulled by Ibrisam's rhythmic gait, and the harsh desert miles unwound beneath him. The dark hills formed strange, wondrous shapes around them, filled with shadows and mystery, and the stars and the crescent moon of Islam lit their way through the night. He gazed up at the sky, not merely to navigate through the darkness and the broken wilderness, but caught up in the mesmeric thrall of the ancient patterns of light and their inexorable march through the heavens. Strangely, this was the time when he felt closer to his past, when he seemed to feel the presence of Tom still near to him. They had spent so many nights together under the starry firmament when they were lads aboard the old Seraph, perched up in the rigging. It had been Aboli, Big Daniel, and Ned Tyler who had taught him the names of all the navigational stars, and he whispered them aloud now. So many had Arabic names. Al-Nilam, Al-Nitak, Mintaka, Saif. Riding in the company of the man who had become his father, and these wild, falcon-fierce warriors whom he commanded, Dorian pondered the ancient prophecy of St. Taim Taim, as he had seen it written on the crumbling walls of the old sage tomb. Slowly he was overcome with an almost religious sense of some immutable destiny awaiting him here under these desert skies. They stopped after midnight, when the great scorpion lay low on the stony hills. One of the sheikhs of the Saar came to the prince to make his farewells and to reiterate his vows. "I go to raise my levy," he told Al-Malik. "Before the full of this moon I will meet you at the wells of Mach Shadid, with 500 lances at my back," he promised. They watched his camel pace away swiftly into the east, until it was lost in the purple shadows. Then they went on. Twice more in the night, other sheikhs detached themselves from the main column, and after they had sought the prince's blessing, slipped away into the sands, leaving with the promise to meet again at the wells of Mach Shadid in the full of the moon. They went on until they discovered a field of lush zara, which had sprung up where, months before, a thunderstorm had drenched a tiny part of the desert. They stopped and let the camels graze, while they cut bundles of the flour, for this was the finest of all camel foods and highly prized. When they had loaded it onto their mounts, they rode on until the dawn turned the eastern horizon orange and pink. They stopped again, this time to camp, couched the camels and fed them on the garnered zara. Then they made coffee and cakes of meal over smoky fires of dried camel dung. When they had eaten, they lay down wrapped in their robes. They slept through the hours of quivering heat, when the rocks danced in the mirage. Dorian lay close beside Ibrisam, in her shadow, and the sound of her belches and the grinding of her jaws as she chewed the cud was familiar and lulling. He slept well, and woke in the evening when the air was cooled. While the column roused itself and prepared for the long night march, Dorian sent a small patrol under Batula to scout ahead along their intended line of march. Then he mounted Ibrisam and rode back to sweep their back trail, making certain that they were not being followed. This was the way of this hard, hostile land, where the tribes lived in a perpetual state of blood feud and war, where raids for camels and women were part of desert life, and vigilance was the centre of every man's existence. Dorian found that the back trail was clear. He turned back, urged Ibrisam into a swinging trot, and soon caught up with the main column. After midnight they reached the bitter wells of Khayel Yayamin. A small encampment of the Saar was already there, and they came out of their tents and surrounded the prince's camel, ululating and firing joy shots in the air. They camped for 2 days under the straggly date palms at Khayel Yayamin, where the water in the wells was so brackish that it could only be drunk when mixed with camel's milk. The men had to climb down deep into the earth to reach it, and they carried it up to the surface in leather bags to water the camels. After the long, waterless journey, the camels drank with relish. Ibrisam drank repeatedly and sucked up 25 gallons during the next few hours. The last of the sheikhs of the Saar left the column here and scattered out into the wilderness to find their people, leaving Prince Al-Malik with only Dorian's small force to guide and protect him on the last leg of the journey to meet the Awamir at the wells of Mukhaid. It took them 3 nights of travel to cross the salt flats before the hills of Shia. Even in the moonlight the flats were white as a snowfield, and the pads of the camels left a dark path over the shiny surface. On the third morning they saw the hills rise far ahead of them, a pale blue line, serrated like the fangs of a tiger shark against the dawn. They camped for the day in a shallow wadi, where a growth of thorny gaff trees gave them some shelter from the sun. Before he lay down to sleep, Dorian climbed to the lip of the wadi to study the line of hills that lay ahead. The red, rugged rock was highlighted by the rising sun. The hills of Shia marked the boundary between the territories of the Sa'a and the Awamiya. Dorian picked out a peak shaped like a castle turret. The Sa'a called it the Witch's Tower. It marked the pass through the range that would take them into the domain of the Awamiya. Dorian smiled with satisfaction that he had led the column across the trackless plains directly to the pass, then stood up and went down into the wadi to find shade and rest for the day. That evening, when the column was ready to continue the march, Dorian rode back as usual to sweep the back trail. Half a mile from the camp, he cut the spoor of a strange camel. By now he had grown so adept in the ways of the desert that he could recognize the tracks of every beast in their column. These tracks showed that the unknown rider had come out of the west and crossed their trail. Dorian read how the man had dismounted to examine their trail, then remounted, and followed it for almost 2 miles before shearing off and riding to a low shale bank that rose like the spine of an elephant out of the salt-white plain. Behind this cover he had left his camel and crawled to the top of the ridge. His snake-like drag marks were clear for Dorian to read. When Dorian followed these to the crest of the ridge, he found that he overlooked the camp among the gaff trees where the column had spent the day. Dorian saw that the stranger had lain on the ridge for a while, then drawn back and run down to where he had tethered his camel. He had ridden off, making a wide circle around the encampment, then headed directly towards the hills of Shia and the Witch's Tower above the pass. The spy had at least 8 hours' lead on the column and would have reached the pass by now. The implications were sinister. The news of the arrival of Al-Malik and his journey through the desert to meet the leaders of the tribes would almost certainly have reached the caliph in Muscat and his Ottoman allies. They might have sent a force to intercept him, and the logical place to set up an ambush would be at the pass of the Witch's Tower. Dorian took only minutes to decide his next action. He swung up onto Ibrisam's saddle and urged her into a run. They sped away across the white flats, and within a short time he saw the column ahead, dark shadows on the shining earth. The rear guard challenged him as he came up, then recognized Ibrisam. "It is Al-Salil, by God!" "Where is Batula?" Dorian shouted as he came within hail. His lance-bearer galloped back to him. As he reached Dorian's side, he threw back his veil and uncovered his face. "You come in haste, master. There is danger." "A stranger rides in our shadow," Dorian told him. "He has watched us from afar while we camped. Then he rode off towards the pass, perhaps to warn the men who are waiting there." Quickly he explained to Batula what he had found, then sent him out with two companions to follow up the tracks of the stranger. He watched them ride away and urged Ibrisam on to catch up with the prince. Al-Malik listened intently while Dorian made his report. "There are many enemies. Almost certainly these are the servants of the Ottoman or of my brother the caliph. Allah knows, there are many who would prevent me reaching the tribes of the interior. What do you plan, my son?" Dorian pointed ahead. The dark hills of Shia were an unbroken barrier rising 500 feet above the salt flats. "Lord, we do not know how many of the enemy there are. I have 30 men, and can laugh at twice or thrice that number of enemy. However, if the Ottoman have got wind of your journey, they may have sent an army to find you."
"That is likely."
"The pass at the Witch's Tower is the main and swiftest route through the hills to reach the Awamiya. But there is another lesser pass further to the west," Dorian pointed across the silver plain. "It is known as the Pass of the Bright Gazelle, and to reach it will take us many leagues out of our way. But I cannot risk riding into the Witch's Tower and being trapped in its gut by a large force of the Ottoman."
Al-Malik nodded. "How far to this other pass? Can we reach it before daybreak?"
"No," Dorian replied. "Even if we drive the camels hard, we will not be there before the middle of the morning."
"Then let us ride," said Al-Malik.
Dorian called to his men of the vanguard and ordered them to change direction towards the west. They closed up, and with the prince in the center of the line, every man alert for an ambush, they pushed the camels harder. The beasts were still fresh and strong, and the salt crystals crunched under their pads. A soft white dust cloud rose up and sparkled behind them in the still night air as they sped forward. They halted for a short while after midnight to let the camels blow and to drink a cup of water mixed with camel's milk.
then went on. In that darkest hour of the night, 4 hours before dawn, there was a shout of alarm from the riders in the rearguard of the column. Dorian turned his camel and raced back. "What is it?" he began, then broke off as he spotted the dark clump of camels coming towards them out of the night. There were few, but they might be outriders of an army. "Close up the ranks," he ordered, and loosened the butt of his lance in its leather boot. Swiftly the column evolved into a defensive formation, with the prince in the centre where they could protect him. Then Dorian urged Iprisam forward and challenged the approaching men with a shouted question. "Al Salil!" The response was immediate, and he recognised Batula's voice. "Batula!" He rode to meet his lance-bearer. They came together at a gallop. Then Dorian turned Iprisam to run alongside Batula's mount so they could talk. "What news?"
"A war party. Many men," Batula replied. "They were waiting at the witch's tower."
"How many?"
500, perhaps more."
"Who?"
"Turks and Masakara."
The Masakara were the tribe from the coastal lands around Muscat, and Sir, Dorian had no doubt that they were the Caliph's men, especially if Turks were with them.
"Encamped?"
"No, they are riding hard in pursuit of us."
"How do they know we've changed direction?"
"I can only guess that they must have many scouts watching us. And we saw your dust cloud for many miles. It shines like a beacon fire in the moonlight."
Dorian looked up and saw it obscuring half the sky above them.
"How far are they behind you?"
Batula threw back the cloth from his face and grinned in the starlight.
"If it were daylight, you would be able to see their dust cloud clearly. Loosen your lance, Al Salil. There will be good fighting before the sun sets tomorrow."
They raced onwards all that night, until the dawn flushed the eastern sky and the light grew stronger.
"Ride on,"
Dorian called to the prince, turned Iprisam aside, and headed for a pimple of dark lava that rose abruptly 50 feet out of the flat white plain to their left. When he reached it, he jumped down from the saddle and scrambled to the top of it. The dawn flared before his eyes, and the light came swiftly, that miraculous birth of the desert day. The wild hills of Shi'ar stood tall and serried ahead of him. Their colours were as gorgeous as those of some tropical bird, bright gold and red, with bars of purple and buttresses of crimson. He could clearly see the pass of the bright gazelle, a dark blue cleft that split the sheer rugged cliffs from top to bottom. The white sands were piled up at the base of the hills in a sloping ramp, and the wind had carved the soft dunes below the gaudy rock face into weird, fantastic shapes. Then Dorian looked back the way they had come and saw the dust cloud of the Turks billowing up from the glistening plain close behind him. At that moment the rising sun shot its first arrow of light through a gap in the crest of the hills. Although Dorian was still in shadow, the plain behind him was lit, and he saw the sunlight sparkle on the lance heads of the approaching riders.
"Batula was wrong," he whispered, as he saw their multitudes. "There are many more than he counted. 1,000, perhaps."
They were spread out over a wide front, many squadrons, some obscured by the dust of those ahead.
"There must have been a traitor," Dorian mused. "They could not have sent this vast array had they not known for certain that the prince was coming this way."
The closest squadron of the enemy was near the centre of the line, a small band that had outstripped the main body, leaving them floundering along behind. They were so close that he could see the shapes of the camels and the riders on their backs through the gossamer sheets of rolling dust. He could not count them, but he guessed there were 200 in this group, and judging from the way in which they rode, they were hard fighting men. He narrowed his eyes as he tried to estimate their speed and compare it to the pace of the fleeing column of his own men. Those camels out there were fresh and fleet, while his own beast had run all night. The enemy were outrunning them, and it would be a closer race to reach the pass of the bright gazelle. He ran down to where Iprisam stood and leapt up onto her back. She sprang away at the touch of his riding wand and fled in pursuit of the column.
As he emerged from behind the cover of the rocks, the pursuers spotted him, and he heard their faint but warlike cries carrying in the cool morning air. Dorian swiveled in the saddle and looked back just in time to see the puffs of gun smoke as the riders in the leading ranks fired at him. The range was too long, and he did not even hear the flight of the musket balls. Ibrisan, the Silk Wind, ran on untouched and caught up with their own band at the start of the sand ramp that led up to the foot of the cliffs. This was a slithering slope of loose crystalline particles that gave under the weight of the camels and ran back like water beneath their pads. The column struggled upwards, sliding back half a pace for every one they gained, and the camels moaned with fear at the treacherous footing. One of the leading animals went down on its haunches, lunging wildly to regain its feet, then rolled backwards, crushing its rider under the saddle. Dorian was close enough to hear the screams and the crackle of the bones as both the man's legs snapped. Then the heavy beast slid back in a tangle to the foot of the ramp, leaving the slope behind it littered with water skins and broken equipment, dragging its rider down with it, caught in the traces. Dorian jumped down, and with his sword cut the injured man free. Batula saw what he was doing and turned back to help him. His mount slid down the slope in sheets of flying sand, and at the bottom he jumped down beside Dorian. Between them they lifted the injured man, his shattered legs dangling up onto Ibrisam's back. The tail of the column was already halfway up the slope. The prince and the vanguard had reached the foot of the rocks and were disappearing into the dark cleft of the pass through the hills. Dorian seized Ibrisam's halter, dragged her head round, and started her up the dune. He glanced back over the plain and saw the pursuit bearing down upon them. Their mounts were stretched out at full run, the dust boiling out behind them, the riders on their backs brandishing their weapons, howling war cries into the wind, robes streaming out behind them, racing in to cut them down while they struggled up the treacherous slope. Abruptly, from high above, came the blast of musket fire. The prince had rallied the men as they reached the mouth of the pass, and the crash of the volley echoed and boomed along the cliff face. Dorian saw at least three of the onrushing riders knocked from the saddle by heavy lead balls, and one of the camels must have been struck in the brain, for it dropped so suddenly that it cartwheeled, haunches overhead, flinging its rider high as it sprawled on the hard-baked earth. The charge lost speed and impetus, and as Dorian and Batula toiled up the soft slope, another volley of musket fire swept over their heads. It was answered by a rattle of rolling fire from the foot of the dunes, where the enemy were dismounting and turning their jezils on the struggling pair exposed on the ramp above them. Lead balls kicked up spurts of sand around Dorian's feet, but there seemed a charm of protection over him, for despite the rain of shots, he and Batula battled on. Running with sweat and gasping for breath, they dragged the camels over the top of the sand ramp and onto the stony ledge at the mouth of the pass. Dorian looked around him swiftly as he heaved and panted for breath. The other camels had been led into shelter behind the first turn of the high stone walls, and his men had couched them there, then run back to take up positions among the rocks from where they could fire down on the enemy. Dorian looked out across the plain below and saw the Ottoman squadrons strung out over miles of the pale earth, but all headed in his direction. He made a swift count of their numbers. Certainly close to 1,000, he decided, and wiped the stinging sweat from his eyes with his headcloth. Then he examined Ibrisam quickly, running his hands over her flanks and haunches, dreading to find blood from a bullet wound. But she was unharmed. He tossed the halter rope to Batula. "Take the camels to safety," he ordered, "and have the injured man cared for." While Batula led the beasts deeper into the gut of the pass, Dorian went to find the prince. Al-Malik squatted, musket in hand, unharmed and composed, quietly directing the musketeers among the rocks. Dorian crouched beside him. "Lord, this is not your business. It is mine." The prince smiled at him. "You have done well thus far. You should have left that clumsy fellow to fend for himself. Your life is worth 100 of his." Dorian ignored both the rebuke and the compliment. He said quietly, "With half the men I can hold the enemy here for many days until our water is spent. I will send Batula and the other half to escort you through the pass and onto the oasis of Mujahid.
The prince looked into his face, his expression grave. The odds would be 20 against 1,000, and though the position was strong, they could expect the enemy to be determined and resourceful. He knew the sacrifice Dorian was offering.
"Leave Batula here," he said, "and come with me to Mujahid."
The tone of his voice was a question, not an order.
"No, my lord," Dorian rejected it. "I cannot do that. My place is here with my men."
"You are right." The prince rose to his feet. "I cannot force you to neglect your duty, but I can command you not to fight here to the death."
Dorian shrugged. "Death makes his own choices. He brooks no argument from us."
"Hold them here for the rest of the day and the night," Al-Malik said. "That will give me time to reach Mujahid and rally the Awamir. I will come back for you with an army."
"As my lord commands," said Dorian. But the prince saw the battle lust in his green eyes, and it made him uneasy.
"Al-Salil," he said firmly, and gripped Dorian's shoulder to reinforce the words. "I cannot tell how long it will take for me to return with the men of the Awamir. Hold them here until dawn tomorrow. No longer than that. Then run to join me as fast as Ibrasam will carry you. You are my talisman, and I cannot afford to lose you."
"Lord, you must leave at once. Every moment is precious."
They went back together to the camels, and Dorian gave swift orders, dividing the men into two groups, those who would stay to hold the pass, and those who would ride with the prince. They shared out what remained of the water and food, a fourth part for the prince, and the remainder for Dorian's party.
"We will leave all of our muskets with you, the 5 barrels of black powder and the bags of lead shot," the prince told Dorian.
"We will put it to good employment," Dorian promised.
Within minutes it was done, and the prince and Batula mounted at the head of the departing party. The prince looked down from the saddle at Dorian.
"Allah be your shield, my son," he said.
"Go with God, my father," Dorian replied.
"That is the first time you have called me that."
"It is the first time I have felt it to be true."
"You do me honour," said Al-Malik gravely, and touched his camel's neck with the riding wand.
Dorian watched them wind away down the narrow passage between the high rock walls and disappear around the first turn. Then he put all else from his mind except the coming battle. He strode back to the entrance to survey the plain and the cliffs with a soldier's eye. He considered the height of the sun. It was only a little past noon. It was going to be a long day and an even longer night. He picked out the weak spots in his defence, which the enemy would exploit, and made his plans as to how he would counter each move they made. First they will try a direct assault straight up the slope, he decided, as he looked at them massing below, on the edge of the plain. He went among his men, laughing and bantering with them, moving them into the best defensive positions among the rocks, making certain that each had full powder flasks and shot bags. He had not finished setting out the last of his pickets before he heard a distant blast of a horn from the bottom of the slope, followed immediately by the beat of war drums and a swelling shout from the first wave of attackers, who rushed forward and started up the slope.
"Steady!" Dorian called to his men. "Hold your fire, brothers of the warrior blood!"
He slapped the shoulder of a man with long dark locks of tangled hair spilling over his shoulders, and they grinned into each other's faces.
"The first shot will be the sweetest, Ahmed. Make it tell."
He went on down the line. "Wait until they are staring down your barrel, Hassan. I want a clean kill from you with your first bullet, Mustafa. Let them get so close that even you cannot miss, Salim." Though he laughed and joked, he was watching the attackers come up the slope. These were Turks, heavier men than the bird-like Arabs of the desert, with long moustaches and round bronze helmets with nosepieces, and gillets of chain armour over their robes of striped wool. Heavy gear for the desert, Dorian thought, as they toiled up the ramp of the loose sand, the first wild rush slowly becoming a laboured climb. Dorian walked out onto the lip of the slope as if to welcome them, and stood with his hands on his hips, grinning down at them.
Not only did he want to inspire his men by his example, he also wanted to make certain that none could disobey his order and open fire while he was standing in front of them. One of the Turks below paused and threw up his musket. His face was shiny with sweat, and his hands shook with the effort of the climb. Dorian steeled himself, and the Turk fired. The ball hissed past Dorian's head, and the wind flipped a lock of his red-gold hair across his cheek and lips.
"Is that the best you goat-lovers can do?"
he laughed down at them.
"Come up here! Come and taste the hospitality of the Tsar!"
His taunts gave the leaders fresh wind, and they broke into a clumsy, lurching run up the last few yards of the ramp. Dorian stepped back into the ranks of his own men.
"Ready now, brethren," he said quietly, and cocked the hammer of his jezel.
A line of Turks came shoulder to shoulder over the lip. Their faces were flushed darkly, bathed in sweat, as they staggered on to the levelled jezels of the Tsar. Most had discarded their own muskets during the climb. Now they brandished their scimitars, and with a hoarse yell threw themselves on the defenders.
"Now!"
shouted Dorian, and the Tsar fired together. 20 muskets in a single prolonged blast of gun smoke and ball. It swept through the lines of Turks. Dorian saw his own shot punch a gap in the yellow teeth of a burly moustached Turk in front of him. The man's head snapped back. Blood and brain tissue burst out of the back of his skull and the sword flew from his hand. He fell back into the man who teetered on the crest of the slope behind him, throwing him off balance so that they fell together and rolled down the sand ramp, knocking down another 3 men who were climbing up it, sending them all down to the bottom.
"Take the blade to them now,"
Dorian called, and they sprang out from behind the rocks and charged into the milling throng of Turks on the ledge. That murderous charge drove the Ottomans back, stumbling over their own dead and over the edge of the ramp. The ledge was cleared, and the Tsar met the men who were still struggling up towards them. They had the advantage of height, and the Turks were almost exhausted by the time they came within sword play. The struggle was swiftly over, and the attackers broken, dead, and wounded. Those who had not been hurt slipped and slithered back down, ignoring the angry shouts of their captains, running over them and carrying them away in the rout. The Tsar danced on the ledge, beards and robes swirling, hurling taunts and obscene insults after the enemy. Dorian saw at a glance that he had not lost a single man, either killed or wounded, while at least a dozen Turkish corpses were half buried in the fine sand of the dune below. "That was only the first course of the banquet," he controlled his own jubilation. No more than 100 Turks had come at them in that rash charge. "They won't try that again." He strode among his men, shouting to them to reload the muskets, but it took him some time to get them under control again. "I want 10 men up in the cliffs." He picked them out by name, and sent them climbing up the rock walls to where they could observe the whole front of the hills and any move the enemy made. He guessed that they would now send men to climb the sand dunes on each side of the mouth of the pass, out of musket range of Dorian's men. Then they would regroup on the ledge and close in from both sides. Combined with another frontal attack, this would be more difficult to resist. Dorian knew that his men must eventually be driven back into the gut of the pass, and it was there in the narrow passage that they would be forced to make their final stand. Relying on the men he had posted high in the cliffs to give warning of the next attack, he took 6 men into the pass to select the best defensive position. It was almost 3 years since he had last travelled this way, but he remembered that there was a narrow place where the rock pinched in. When he found it again, the gap was barely wide enough for a loaded camel to pass through. Beyond it was a rockfall, and at his orders the 6 Tsar laid aside their weapons and used the loose rock from the fall to fortify the gap, building a sangar across it, behind which they could shelter. The camels were couched deeper in the pass beyond the next twist of the passage, and Dorian went to check that they were saddled and ready for a quick escape when the enemy broke through the sangar. Ibrisam groaned with love when she saw him, and he caressed her head before he left her to go back to the mouth of the pass. The men he had sent to climb the rock walls were in position above him, and the others were spread out along the ledge. They were loading the extra muskets that the prince had left with them, and setting these close at hand. That would give them an extra shot when the fighting was heavy. Dorian squatted on the ledge and looked down upon the enemy. Even though the sun was high now and the heat becoming fierce, the white salt flats swarmed with activity. Troops of mounted men were still coming up to swell the ranks of the enemy, and Turkish officers were riding back and forth along the foot of the sand dunes, studying the lie of the land. Their helmets and weapons sparkled, and the white dust hung in a shimmering curtain over them. Suddenly there was an even more agitated movement among the troops directly below where Dorian sat, and a horn sounded a fanfare. A small party was approaching, the outriders carrying banners of green and scarlet, the colours of the Sublime Porte. There could be little doubt that this was the command party of the enemy force. As they drew closer, Dorian studied them with interest. He picked out two figures in the centre of the group, who, judging by their splendid dress and the rich caparisons of their camels, were high-ranking officers. One was a Turk, for he carried the round bronze shield and wore the helmet with steel nosepiece. The Ottoman general, Dorian decided, and turned his attention to the second man, an Arab. Even at this distance, there was something vaguely familiar about him, and Dorian stirred uneasily. He was swaddled in fine woolen robes, but Dorian could see he was a big man. The band of his headdress was of gold filigree, and the scabbard of the curved dagger on his waist shone with the same lustrous metal. There were even gold sandals on his feet. "Damn me, but I know him." Dorian's sense of recognition grew stronger, and he racked his memory to try to put a name to him. The command party drew up at the foot of the dunes, well out of musket shot of Dorian's men on the ledge, and the Turkish commander lifted a telescope to his eye and peered up at the mouth of the pass. He completed a leisurely survey of the cliff face, then lowered the glass and spoke to his officers, who were grouped obsequiously behind him. Immediately they wheeled away and began to give orders to the squadrons of waiting troops. There was another burst of activity. They were doing exactly what Dorian had anticipated. Within a short while, hundreds of heavily armed men were climbing the slope on both sides of the mouth of the pass. They were keeping well out of musket shot of the little group of defenders, but Dorian knew that when they reached the ledge, they would creep in, then try to rush the entrance to the pass. "Al Salim! The dung-eating Turks are coming up to us again!" Dorian's lookouts on the cliffs above called their observations down to him. From their vantage points, they could see more than he, and they warned him when the first of the enemy reached the ledge and began to move along it towards the centre. "Shoot any who come within range!" Dorian shouted back, and immediately a fusillade of musket shots echoed along the cliff. The Tsar were firing down upon the ledge, and the Turks were returning their fire. Occasionally there came a scream as a man was hit, but the shouts from the lookouts warned that the enemy were gradually working into a position from which they could launch their first assault on the mouth of the pass. Even though he was distracted by action all around him, Dorian kept watching the gold-bedecked Arab who rode beside the Turkish general. At last a train of baggage camels came up from the rear, and from these were offloaded a painted leather tent. 20 men unrolled it, set it up on the white plain, and spread rugs and cushions in its shade. The Turkish general dismounted and went to take his place on the rugs. The Arab dandy couched his camel also and clambered down awkwardly from the saddle. He followed the Turk to the tent, and now Dorian could see the breadth of his shoulders and the swell of his belly under the woolen robe. He had not taken more than a few paces when Dorian noticed the limp. He was favouring his right foot. It was enough to jolt his memory. He remembered their fight on the steps of the old tomb in the garden of the Zenana at Lamu, and the fall that had broken that foot. "Zayn," he whispered. "Zayn al-Din." It was his old enemy from childhood days, now costumed like a prince of Oman and riding at the head of an army. Dorian felt all the old hatred and antagonism return in full flood. Zayn was the enemy once again. But what's he doing here? Hunting his own father? Dorian puzzled. Does he know that I am here also? He tried to make sense out of this strange, unlooked-for circumstance. Zain had been at the court of Muscat for so long that he would have been caught up in the convoluted maelstrom of royal intrigue, probably trained and encouraged by his uncle, the Caliph. Unless Zain had changed greatly from the boy Dorian had known, he would have taken readily to the conspiracies of the court. It was clear that he had become another pawn of the Sublime Porte. Perhaps he was at the centre of the capitulation of Omam to the Ottoman. "You traitorous swine," Dorian muttered, staring down at him with loathing. "You would sell your country and your people, even your own father. What was the price? What reward have the Porte offered you, Zain? The throne itself, as their puppet in Muscat?" Zain al-Din took his seat beside the Turkish general in the shade of the tent fly, and a slave placed a cup in his hand. He sipped from it, and Dorian saw that he had grown a thin, straggling beard, but that his cheeks were smooth and plump. He stared up directly at Dorian, who pulled off the headdress and shook out his shining gold curls. The cup slipped from Zain's fingers as he recognized him. Dorian waved gaily at him. Zain made no reply, but seemed to crouch a little lower, hunching down like a bloated toad. At that moment there was a sudden heavy burst of firing along the cliffs on the right, and Dorian turned away to bolster the defence on that side of the pass.
"Beware, Al-Salil," one of the lookouts called. "They are coming."
"How many?" Dorian shouted back, and dropped behind the rock with Ahmed.
"Many," came the reply. "Too many."
On this side the cliffs formed a jagged buttress that turned back upon itself, so that they could not see more than 20 paces along the open ledge, but they could hear the voices of the men beyond the corner of the cliff, and their footsteps as they pressed forward, the clatter of a bronze shield on rock, the creak of leather thongs on breastplate and scabbard belt.
"Steady," Dorian called to his men. "Wait for them. Let them come close."
Suddenly a rank of Turks charged around the corner of the cliff straight at them. The ledge was only wide enough for three at a time, but others pressed close behind them, right on their heels.
"Allah Akbar," they howled. "God is great."
There was a tall, pockmarked man in the front rank with a steel Saracen helmet on his head, chainmail covering his torso and a double-bladed battle-axe in his hands. He jumped out ahead of his comrades and singled out Dorian, locking eyes with him and charging straight at him with the axe held in both hands above his head. He was an arm's length away. The muzzle of the long jezel almost touched his face as Dorian fired. The ball hit the Turk in the throat, and he dropped to his knees, clutching the wound. A severed artery pumped out blood between his fingers in thick, glutinous jets, and he fell forward on his face. Dorian dropped the empty musket and snatched up the loaded one that lay at hand and cocked the hammer. Another man jumped over the dying Turk, and Dorian shot him in the chest. He went down kicking and twitching on the rock ledge. Dorian threw down the empty musket and drew his sword. He stepped forward to block the ledge. Ahmed was on his right and Salim on the left, their shoulders touching. The enemy came at them in a mob, three at a time, but with others close behind, ready to step into the gaps left by the men who fell. Dorian loved the feel of a good blade in his hand. This weapon he held now had been a parting gift from the prince when he had sailed from Lamu. It was of Damascus steel, limber as a willow wand and sharp as the tooth of a serpent. He killed the first man who came at him cleanly, lunging under the rim of his helmet into his dark eye, skewering the eyeball like a sheep's kidney on a kebab, and sending the steel on into his brain. Recovering swiftly, Dorian disengaged the blade and let his victim drop. Then the others rushed forward behind their bronze shields, and there was no longer space nor pause for fine swordplay. Shoulder to shoulder, in the pack and surge, they hacked and stabbed and shouted, swaying back and forth and side to side across the narrow ledge. The warning cry from the Tsar lookouts in the cliff face was almost drowned by the shouting, the clatter of steel on steel, the trampling and shoving.
"On to the left side and the front!"
Dorian heard it, and cut down another man before he jumped back from the fight, letting Mustafa, who was behind him, move up into his place in the line. He looked about him and saw that while he had been fighting on the right, the Turks had launched a series of attacks at every other point. Five of his men were fighting desperately to hold the far side of the entrance where the enemy were pressing forward along the ledge. At the same time, 200 Turks were coming directly up the sand slope to their front. In the few moments that it took him to make this appraisal, two of his men were killed. Salim had half his head cut away by the swing of an axe blade, and Mustafa took a sword thrust through the lungs and dropped to his knees, belching bright gouts of blood. Dorian knew he could not afford these losses, and the Turks coming up the slope had almost reached the ledge. The men he had placed in the cliffs had not waited for his order, but were scrambling down to join the fighting. He was grateful when they jumped the last 10 feet onto the rock beside him. By now both his flanks were buckling under the pressure, and at any moment a wave of the enemy would come roaring over the front of the ledge. "Back to back!" Dorian yelled. "Cover each other! Back into the pass!" They formed a tight defensive ring, and the Turks bayed around them as they fell back quickly into the mouth of the pass. But they lost more men to the flashing blades and musket balls fired at close range. "Now," Dorian gave the order, "run!" They spun round and pounded back deeper into the pass, dragging their wounded with them, while the enemy jammed in the entrance, obstructing each other by their numbers as they tried to pursue. Dorian was in the lead as they raced around the bend in the rock passage, and he shouted to the 6 men behind the walls of the sangar, "Hold your fire! It's us!" The rock wall of the sangar was chest high, and they had to scramble over it. The men waiting behind the wall helped to drag the wounded over the top. As the last of the Saar fell over the wall, the enemy came roaring down the rock passage close behind him. The 6 men who had not taken any part in the fighting so far were desperate to join in. They had loaded all the remaining muskets and stacked them along the side of the cliff, and they had planted the long lances in the earth close at hand for when the Turks breached the sangar. The first volley into the front rank of the Turks brought them up short, and there was confusion and dismay as those in front tried to retreat and their comrades coming up behind pushed them forward. Another close-quarter volley with the second battery of reloaded muskets tipped the balance, and the remaining Turks fled back down the passage to disappear around the bend in the rock. Although they were hidden by the curved rock wall, the voices of the Turks were magnified by the surrounding walls, and Dorian could hear every word as they cursed the Tsar and urged each other to attack again. He knew that there would be only a brief respite before the next assault. "Water," he ordered. "Bring a water skin." The heat in the pass was like a bread oven, and the fighting had been heavy and hot. They gulped down the foul, brackish liquid from the bitter wells at Khayel Yayamin, as though it was sweet sherbet. "Where is Hassan?" Doran asked as he counted heads. "I saw him fall," one of his men replied, "but I was carrying Zaid, and I could not go back for him." Dorian felt the loss, for Hassan had been one of his favourites. Now he had only 12 men still able to fight. They had dragged back 5 of their wounded, but others had had to be left to the mercy of the Turks. Now they carried the 5 wounded back to where the camels were couched. Then Dorian divided the survivors into 4 equal groups. The wall of the sangar was wide enough for only 3 of them to man it at a time. Dorian positioned the 3 other groups behind the leading rank. After each volley, they would fall back to reload, and the other ranks would step up to take their turn. In this fashion, he hoped to maintain a steady fire into the Turks as they came forward to the attack. He might be able to hold them off until dark, but he doubted that they could survive the night. So few of the Tsar were still on their feet, and the Turks had a reputation as terrible and doughty fighters. He knew they would be resourceful enough to find some strategy to thwart their best efforts of defence. All he could hope for was to buy time for Al-Malik, and in the end they would have to try to fight their way out with lance and sword. They settled down behind the sangar in the hushed, heated air of the pass, husbanding their strength. "I would trade my place in paradise for a pipe of kief now," Mishka grinned as he wrapped a strip of filthy, sweat-soaked cloth around the sword cut in his upper arm. The heady smoke of the herb made the smoker fearless and oblivious to the pain of his wounds.
"I will make one for you and light it with my own hands when we sit in the halls of Muscat," Dorian promised, then broke off as somebody called his name.
"Al-Salil! My brother!"
The voice echoed and resonated from the rock.
"My heart rejoices to see you again."
It was high-pitched, almost girlish.
Although the timbre had changed, Dorian recognized it.
"How is your foot, Zayn al-Din?" he called back. "Come, let me break the other for you, to balance your duck waddle."
Out of sight behind the bend of the passage, Zayn giggled.
"We will come, my brother. Believe me, we will come, and when we do, I shall laugh while my Turkish allies lift the skirts of your robe and bend you over the saddle of your camel."
"I think you would enjoy that more than I would, Zayn." Dorian used the feminine form of address, as though he were speaking to a woman, and Zayn was silent for a while.
"Listen, Al-Salil," he shouted again. "This is your blood brother Hassan. You left him behind when you ran like a cowardly jackal. He still lives."
Dorian felt a chill of dread blow down his spine. "He is a brave man, Zayn al-Din. Let him die with dignity," he called back. Hassan had been his friend since the first day he had come to live among the Tsar. He had two young wives and four little sons, the oldest only 5 years of age. A terrible scream came down the passage, a scream of mortal agony and outrage, which descended into a sobbing moan.
"Here is a gift for you from your friend."
Something small, soft, and bloody was lobbed around the corner of the passage. It rolled in the sandy earth and came to rest in front of the Sangha wall.
"You are in need of another pair of balls, Al-Salil, my brother," Zayn al-Din called. "There they are. Hassan will not need them where he is going."
The Tsar growled and cursed, and Dorian felt tears sting his eyelids. His voice choked as he shouted back, "I swear in the name of God that I will do the same for you one day."
"Oh, my brother," Zayn called back, "if this dog of a Tsar is so dear to you, I will send him back to you, but before I do, I wish to look at his liver."
There was another terrible scream. Then Hassan was thrust out into the open and sent staggering down the passage towards the Sangha. He was naked, and between his legs was a dark hole, mushy with blood. They had ripped open his belly, and his entrails dangled around his knees, slippery and purple. He reeled towards Dorian, his mouth open. He made a cawing animal sound, and his mouth was a blood-drenched cave. Zayn al-Din had cut out his tongue. Before he reached the Sangha wall, he collapsed and lay wriggling weakly in the dust. Dorian leapt over the wall with the musket in his hand. He placed the muzzle at the back of Hassan's head and fired. His skull collapsed like a rotten melon. At the sound of the shot, the Turks came pouring down the passage like a wave of storm water. Dorian jumped back over the wall.
"Fire!"
he shouted to his men, and the first volley of musket balls slapped like thrown gravel into the front rank of the attackers. The fighting raged back and forth for the few hours of daylight that remained. Gradually the passage clogged with the enemy dead. They were piled almost as high as the rock wall, and a thick fog of gun smoke filled the depths of the pass so that the air was hard to breathe, and they panted and gasped as they fired and reloaded. The smoke mingled with the metallic smell of blood and the gas from the torn intestines, and in the heat the sweat poured down their bodies and burned their eyes with its salt. Using their own dead as an assault ladder, the Turks managed to climb over the top of the wall three times, and three times Dorian and his Tsar hurled them back. As darkness fell, there were only seven Arabs still able to stand beside him, and all were wounded. In the lull between each attack, they dragged their dead and wounded back to where the camels were couched. There was no one to tend the injured men, so Dorian placed a water skin beside those who still had the strength to drink from it. Jaub, who was nicknamed the Cat,
had had his right shoulder shattered by the blow of a battle axe, and Dorian could not staunch the pumping arterial bleeding.
"It is time for me to leave you, Al Salil,"
Jaub whispered as he struggled to his knees.
"Hold my sword for me."
Dorian could not refuse this last request. He could not leave this comrade of a dozen battles to the Turks. With ice in his heart, he set the hilt of the sword firmly in the sand and placed the point of the curved blade in the notch below the sternum, aimed up towards the heart.
"The blessing of Allah and his prophet on you, my friend,"
Jaub thanked him and fell forward. The blade slid in full length, and the point, smeared with blood, came out between his shoulder blades. Dorian stood up and ran back to the wall just as another rush of Turks came howling down the gut of the pass. They hurled them back at last, but two more of the Tsar had gone down. I had hoped to hold them longer, Dorian thought, as he leaned heavily on the blood-soaked wall. I had hoped to give my father more time to raise the Awamir. But there are too few of us left, and it is almost over now. It was becoming very dark in the passage. Soon the Turks would be able to creep up to the foot of the wall unseen.
"Bin Shibam,"
he croaked to the man beside him, for his throat was swollen with thirst and strained with shouting.
"Bring the last water skin and the bundles of firewood from the camel loads. We will drink and light the night with our last fire."
The leaping flames lit the rock walls of the pass with a ruddy, flickering light, and at intervals one of the Tsar threw a burning brand over the wall to dispel the shadows in which the Turks might crawl forward. There was a lull now. They could hear the Turks talking beyond the bend, and the groans of the wounded and dying were hideous. But still the next attack did not come. They sat in a small, lonely huddle against the wall, drinking the last of the water and helping each other bind up their wounds. All of them were hurt, but although Dorian had been in the thick of the fighting all that day, his injuries were the least grave. There was a deep cut on the back of his left arm and a sword thrust through the same shoulder.
"But I still have my right arm to wield a sword," he told the man who was fashioning an arm sling for him from a length of rope from the camel tack. "I think we have done all we can here. If any of you wishes to leave, take a camel and ride with my thanks and my blessing."
"This is a good place to die," said the man beside him.
"The Uris of Paradise will be sad that we disregard their call," another refused Dorian's offer.
Then they all looked up in mild alarm as a pebble clattered down from high above, bouncing from wall to wall, striking tiny sparks from the rock.
"They have climbed the cliffs and are over our heads," Dorian jumped to his feet. "Douse the fire."
The flames would light them for the men high above to see their position.
His warning came too late.
Suddenly the air around them was filled with a thunderous roar, like that of a great waterfall, and a bombardment of rocks came hurtling down upon them. Some of the boulders were the size of powder kegs, others only as large as a man's head, but there was no shelter from this lethal rain in the gut of the pass. Three more men were crushed in the first few moments, and the others struck down as they ran back along the passage to the camels. Dorian was the only one to get through. He reached Ibrisam's side and threw himself into the saddle. "Hut, hut!" he urged her to her feet. But as she rose, the bombardment of boulders ceased abruptly, and the Turks swarmed over the wall behind him. They stabbed the wounded Arabs, then, with barely a pause, rushed forward to surround Ibrisam. Dorian hit one of them in the chest with the lance, driving the steel head in deeply against the clinging resistance of living flesh, but the shaft snapped off in his hand, and he hurled the stump into the face of another Turk and drew his sword. He slashed at the heads of the men who were trying to pull him down from the saddle and drove Ibrisam back down the passage. She kicked out at the men who stood in her way, clashing her huge yellow teeth, biting all the fingers of one man's hand and crushing another's ribs with a single blow from her forefoot. Then she bounded forward and broke through their ranks. Dorian clung to the pommel of the saddle with his good hand as Ibrisam ran free, following the bends and convulsions of the pass. The bloodthirsty yells of the Turks dwindled behind them. The pass ran a mile or more through the hills. A dry watercourse formed when a softer stratum of rock had been washed out by stormwater over the millennia. Once they were clear of their pursuers, Ibrisam shifted into that smooth pacing trot that covered the ground swiftly and had given her the name Silk Wind. Dorian fell into a trance from thirst, exhaustion, and the stiffening pain of his wounds. The walls of the pass streamed past him endlessly, mesmerizing him further. Once he almost toppled from the saddle, but Ibrisam felt him slump and came to an abrupt halt. This roused Dorian, and he sat more firmly in the saddle when she went on. Only then did he become aware that her gait was hampered, but he was confused and dazed, barely able to keep his seat. The effort required to dismount and check her condition was too much for him. Once again he dozed, and when he started awake, he found that they had emerged from the far end of the pass and were out into the open country of the Awamir. He could tell from the height of the moon and the position of the stars that it was after midnight. The night was icy cold, a cruel contrast to the burning heat of the day. The blood and sweat that soaked his robe chilled him further, and he was shivering and light-headed. Ibrisam was moving strangely under him, her pace short and her back hunched. At last he summoned the strength and resolve to order her to halt and couch. He tested the water skin that hung over her withers and found that it contained less than a gallon of the stinking water from Khail Yayamin. He took his thick woolen shawl out of the carrying net and spread it over his shoulders. Still shivering, he examined Ibrisam to find the cause of her distress. He saw at once that her rump was wet and shining in the moonlight, and discovered that she was scouring heavily. The liquid dung she was passing was dark red with blood. Dorian felt a plunge of dismay. His own injuries and misery forgotten, he palpated her sleek, smooth flanks, but when he touched her belly just forward of her back legs, she moaned softly, and his hand came away wet and shining with blood. A thrust from a Turkish lance had cut deep into her belly and ruptured her bowels. She was mortally wounded, and it was a miracle of love and determination that she had carried him this far. Dorian was so weak and sad that his tears welled. He untied the leather bucket from the load and filled it with the last of the water from the skin. He drank half a pint of the filthy liquid, then went to kneel at Ibrisam's head. "My brave darling," he said, and gave her to drink of what remained in the bucket. She sucked up the water eagerly, and when it was finished, she snuffled the bottom. "There is nothing more I can do for you," he told her, as he stroked her ears. She loved him to do that. "You will be dead by morning," he said, "and I with you, unless you can carry me a little further, for the Turks will follow closely. Will you carry me for the last time?" He stood up and called to her softly, "Hut, hut." She swung her head and looked at him with those great dark eyes swimming with agony. "Hut, hut," he said, and she groaned, roared, and heaved herself upright. Dorian dragged himself up into the saddle. She went on at that cramped, painful gait, following the tracks that the prince and Batula had left through the broken hills and deep wadis. Dorian almost toppled again, but he rallied and used the empty carrying net to tie himself into the saddle. He dozed, jerked awake, and dozed again, slowly sinking into a coma. He lost all track of time, speed, direction, and they wandered on, the dying beast and the man. An hour after dawn, just as the cruel flail of the sun scourged them once again, Ibrisam went down for the last time. She died on her feet, still trying to struggle forward. With a last low moan, she fell heavily, throwing him from the saddle to sprawl on the rock-strewn earth. Dorian crawled to his knees, then dragged himself into the shade of Ibrisam's carcass. He forced himself not to think about the death of his beloved beast, or the loss of so many of his men. He had to concentrate all his strength and wits on staying alive until Batula could lead the Awamir back to rescue him. He saw the heavy tracks of many camels in the loose earth ahead of him, and realized that even in her death throes, Ibrisam had still faithfully followed the route that Batula and the prince had taken towards the oasis at Mukhaid. That might yet save his life, for when they returned, they would come back along their own tracks. It was the rule of survival in the desert not to leave a place of safety and wander off into the wilderness. But Dorian knew that the Turks were following him. Zayn al-Din would not let him go so easily. The enemy must be close, and if they found him before Batula returned, he could expect the same treatment that Zayn had given to the wounded he had captured at the pass of the Bright Gazelle. He must go on to meet Batula, and he must try to keep ahead of the following Turks for as long as he had the strength to remain on his feet. He stood up shakily and looked down at the load that Ibrisam had carried. Was there anything that might be of use to him? He unhooked the water skin, shook it, then held it high with both hands, the spout to his lips. A few bitter drops slid reluctantly into his mouth, and he swallowed painfully, his throat already swelling. Then he dropped the empty skin. Weapons. He looked to what he had with him. There was his jezel in the leather scabbard, and the powder flask and shot bag. The buttstock of the musket was inlaid with ivory and mother of pearl, the lock chased with silver. It weighed almost 7 pounds, too heavy to carry. Leave it. His broken lance had been left at the pass, and the sword would weigh him down. Its weight would seem to double with every mile he walked. Sadly, he unbuckled the belt and let it drop. He kept the dagger. He would need that at the end. The edge was keen. He had honed it until he could have shed the red gold hairs from his own forearm with it. When the Turks closed in, he would fall on it, choosing a clean death rather than emasculation and disembowelment. He looked down at Ibrisam and said, "There's one last thing I ask you for, my darling." He knelt beside her and slit open her belly with the dagger. From her stomach he took handfuls of the contents and squeezed out the liquid between his fingers and drank it. It was bitter with gall, and he had to control the urge to vomit it out again, but he knew it would give him the strength to survive a few more hours under the cruel sun. He rebound his wounds, found that the bleeding had stopped and that black scabs had formed. Then he tightened the straps of his sandals and spread the shawl over his head to fend off the brutal sunlight. Without looking back at Ibrisam, he struck out along the tracks of the prince's party towards a horizon that was already wavering with the blue heat mirage. An hour or so later, he fell for the first time. His legs seemed to turn to water under him, and he went down face first. His open mouth was filled with dry, chalky earth, and he almost choked as he tried to spit it out. There was no saliva left in his mouth, and the dust was sucked into his lungs as he panted for air. He struggled into a sitting position, coughed and gasped. The effort saved him from sinking into coma. He wiped his face with the tail of his headdress, and there was no spittle on his lips or sweat on his face. He forced himself back onto his feet. Though he lurched and staggered, almost fell again, he kept himself upright, and some little strength returned to his legs. He walked on, and the sunlight burned deep into his eyes, seeming to cook the contents of his skull. He felt his dry lips tear like parchment as he tried to swallow, and there was the slow, metallic weep of salty blood into his mouth. The pain and thirst slowly receded, and he entered that dreamlike state where there was no feeling. He heard music, sweet and melodious. He stopped and looked about him blearily, saw Tom and Yasmini standing together on the crest of the slope he was climbing. They were both waving and laughing. "Don't be a baby, Dorry," Tom shouted. "Come on, Dowie." Yasmini danced like a dainty elf beside him, swirling her skirts. He had forgotten how pretty she was. "Come with me, Dowie. I will take you down the Angel's Road again." Dorian broke into a shambling, unsteady run, and the pair on the hill turned and waved at him before they disappeared over the crest. He felt as though each pace he took was through deep, loose sand, and he stumbled over a rock had to windmill his arms to prevent himself falling. But he reached the crest and looked down into the valley beyond. He stared in amazement, for the valley was filled with green trees laden with ripe red fruit, and there were fields of lush English grass leading down to a lake of sparkling water. Tom had gone, but Yasmini stood naked at the edge of the lake. Her body was sleek and slim, her skin a lovely golden shade, and her hair with its silver blaze rippled down to her waist. Her little apple-shaped breasts peered shyly through the shimmering curtain of her hair. "Dowie!" she called, and her voice was as sweet as the dawn call of a desert thrush. "Dowie! I have waited for you for so long." He tried to run down to her, but his legs gave way again and he fell. He was too weary to lift his head.
"Just let me sleep a little, Yassi," he pleaded.
But no sound came from his swollen throat, and his tongue seemed to fill his mouth and cleave to the roof. With another huge effort, he opened his eyes, and with a terrible sense of loss, he realized that Yasmini and the lake were gone. There was only the harsh, burning wilderness below him, rock, thorn, and sand. He rolled over to look back down the hill, and saw the patrol of Ottoman cavalry. They were coursing along his back track, 50 men on racing camels, still 2 sea miles behind him, but coming on apace. He knew that they, at least, were not phantoms. He crawled a short way on hands and knees, then launched himself to his feet. His knees buckled, but he fought off the weakness and staggered over the crest of the hill. The gradient helped him to run on. He heard the music again, but now it filled the heavens. Hundreds of voices were singing. He lifted his eyes and saw the heavenly choir, a throng of angels clustered around the sun, so glorious that they starred his vision like the reflections from the facets of a great diamond. "Come to God," they sang. "Surrender yourself to the will of God."
"Yes," he mumbled,
and the sound of his own voice was strange in his ears, coming from a great distance. "Yes, I am ready." As he said it, a miracle occurred. God appeared to him. God was tall. He wore a robe of blinding white, and the rays of the sun behind his head formed a golden nimbus. His countenance was beautiful, noble, handsome, and filled with great compassion. God lifted his right hand in a gesture of blessing, and his eyes were filled with love as he looked down at Dorian. Dorian felt as though God's strength was flowing into his body, charging his soul with an infinite sense of holiness and reverence. He fell to his knees and used this new strength to shout aloud, "I bear witness that there is no God but God, and Muhammad is his prophet." God's beautiful face shone with benevolence. He strode forward, lifted Dorian to his feet and embraced him, kissed his blackened, bleeding lips. "My son," God said. But he spoke with the voice of Prince Abd Muhammad al-Malik. "Your acceptance of the one true faith fills my heart with joy. Now the prophecy fulfills itself, and I give thanks to God that we have found you in time." Dorian sagged in the prince's arms, and Al-Malik shouted to the men who followed him closely, "Water! Batula! Bring water!" Batula squeezed cool, sweet water from a sponge between Dorian's lips and lifted him onto the litter they had prepared for this moment. A dozen men of the Awamir raised it onto the back of one of the baggage camels. High on the swaying litter, Dorian rolled his head and through bloodshot eyes between swollen lids saw the hordes of the Awamir coming across the plain. Then, on the skyline above, the Turkish patrol appeared and reined in their camels in their own dust cloud. They gazed down in astonishment and sudden trepidation on the army of the Awamir. A great shout of "Allahu Akbar!" went up from the ranks of the Awamir. They couched their long lances and swept forward to battle. The Turks turned and fled before them. Dorian sagged back on the litter, closed his eyes, and let the darkness overwhelm him. There were almost 6,000 fighting men in the column of Awamir that streamed back through the pass of the Bright Gazelle. The salt flats beyond the pass were clear of the enemy. Their scouts had reported the approach of the prince's army, and they had fled back into the north towards Muscat. Al-Malik paused at the pass to give decent burial to the broken bodies of the Tsar who had died there. Dorian was still too weak and sick to rise from his litter, but he had Batula and four others carry him to the graveside, and for the first time he prayed as a Muslim in the community of other believers as they recited the prayer for the dead. Then the army went on across the salt flats to the bitter wells at Khayl Yayamin, where the warriors of the Tsar had already assembled, adding another 3,000 lances to the prince's array. The sheikhs of the Tsar came to the tent where Dorian lay that night, crowded around his litter, and demanded that he tell them every detail of the fight at the Pass of the Bright Gazelle. They interrupted the recitation with exclamations of wonder as he told them how each of the Tsar had died, the fathers and brothers of the dead men weeping with pride. "By Allah, a fight in which Hassan would have been happy to die. In God's name, Salim was a man. Allah will prepare a place in paradise for my son Mustafa." They were fierce for war and revenge, for the blood feud could be settled only in blood, and they spat in the sand and swore their oaths of retribution against Zayn al-Din and the Turks. In his heart, Dorian swore the same oaths with them. Then each noon and evening that the army camped at Khayl Yayamin, they came again to his tent to hear the story repeated, and they corrected Dorian if he left out a single detail, pleading with him to remember every blow and shot and exactly what each of the Tsar had done and said before he died. From Khayl Yayamin, the army set out north on the next leg of the long journey to Muscat. At each well and pass through the mountains, the other tribes came to join them, the Balkhaf and the Afar and the Bait, Kater and the Harasis, so that by the time they reached Mukaibara, they were 15,000 lances together, a mighty host that spread back 10 miles across the desert. Batula whispered the story of Dorian's conversion to one of his companions. No Arab could keep a secret, certainly not one as poignant as this, and the tale was told around every campfire, and the warriors repeated the prophecy of the ancient Saint Taim Taim, for many had read the text of it on the walls of his tomb. They debated it endlessly and swore in God's name that Al-Salil was verily the orphan of the prophecy, and that with him in their company the victory was assured. Before Ramadan came again, they would install Prince Abd Muhammad al-Malik on the elephant throne in the halls of Muscat. In the weeks that it took the army to travel from Khayl Yayamin to Mukaibara, Dorian's injuries healed cleanly, for in the desert there are no evil humours to make wounds corrupt and mortify. When he was ready to take his place in the ranks once more, the prince sent for him. As he strode through the encampment, every tribe cheered him and followed him to the tent of the prince. They massed around the open doorway as Dorian knelt before Al-Malik and asked of him, "Give me your blessing, father." "You have my gratitude and my blessing, son, and much more besides." Al-Malik clapped his hands, and Batula led forward four beautiful thoroughbred racing camels. Each was richly caparisoned, and carried lance, sword, and jezel in the scabbards on their backs. "This is my gift to you, to repay in small coin what you lost at the Pass of the Bright Gazelle." "I thank you for your generosity, father, though I look for no reward for what was only my duty." Al-Malik clapped his hands again, and two heavily veiled old women of the Tsar came to Dorian and laid a bundle of folded silk at his feet. "These are the mothers of Hassan and Salim who died at the pass," the prince explained. "They have begged me for the honour of sewing and embroidering your battle pennant." The women spread out the banner upon the floor of the tent. It was 6 feet long, of azure blue silk, and embroidered upon it in silver metal thread was the prophecy of Saint Taim Taim. The elegant script flowed and swirled upon the silken ground, like the currents and whirlpools in the surface of a swift blue river. "Father, this is the pennant of a sheikh," Dorian protested.
"And that is what you are now." Al-Malik smiled fondly at him. "I have raised you to that rank. I know that you will bear it with honour."
Dorian stood up and held the banner high above his head, then ran with it out into the sunlight. The crowds opened before him, shouted their acclamation, and fired their muskets in the air. The banner streamed out behind Dorian like a blue serpent on the wind. He came back to the prince's tent and prostrated himself before him.
"You do me too much honour, lord."
"In the coming battle you shall command the left flank, Sheikh al-Salil," the prince told him. "I shall place 4,000 lances under your pennant."
Dorian sat up and looked gravely into the prince's eyes.
"Father, may I speak to you in secrecy?"
Al-Malik gestured for the leather sides of the tent to be lowered, for Al-Alama and his retinue to retire and leave the two of them together.
"What more do you ask of me, my son?"
Al-Malik leaned closer to him.
"Speak, and you shall have it."
In reply, Dorian spread the azure banner and traced with his finger the words of the prophecy. "He shall bring together the sands of the desert which are divided," he read aloud.
"Continue,"
the prince ordered, frowning.
"I do not know your meaning."
"It seems that the holy saint placed a further duty upon me. It comes to me that when he speaks of the sands of the desert, the saint was speaking of the tribes who are divided and at war with each other." Now the prince nodded.
"This may well be true," he admitted. "Although most of the tribes have come to us, the Masakara, the Hat, and the Bani Buhasan, will beat the war drum for Yakub and the Sublime Porte."
"Let me go to them under this banner," Dorian pleaded. "Let them see the colour of my hair, and I shall debate the prophecy with them. Then, if Allah is kind, I shall bring over another 10,000 lances to your side."
"No,"
Al-Malik started up in alarm.
"The Masakara are treacherous. They will disembowel you and peg you out in the sun. I cannot allow you to run such a risk."
"I have fought against them," Dorian said softly. "They must accord me the respect of an honourable foe. If I came to them alone and placed myself in their power as a traveller, then they dare not go against the teachings of the prophet. They must listen to what I have to say to them." The prince looked unhappy and stroked his beard in agitation. But what Dorian had said was true. The prophet had placed a duty of host on his believers. They were obliged to protect the traveller in their midst.
"Still, I cannot allow you to place yourself in such jeopardy," he said at last.
Dorian argued. "One life at risk, but 10,000 lances as the stake."
"Father, you cannot deny me this chance to fulfil my destiny as it is written."
At last the prince sighed.
"How can the Masakara prevail against your eloquence?"
"I cannot."
"You may go to them, El Salil, as my emissary. But I swear on the red beard of the prophet that if they harm you in any way, there will be such a lopping of heads as will gorge every vulture in Araby until they cannot fly."
At sunset the following evening, the prince sat alone on a rock on the crest of a low hill beyond the oasis. Four camels slipped out of the encampment of the army and rode past his hilltop, heading northwards into the purple shadows. Dorian rode the first, leading the second on a long rein. Batula followed him, also leading a second camel. Both men were veiled. When he looked up at the prince, Dorian dipped his lance in salute, and the prince lifted his right hand in blessing. Then Abd Muhammad al-Malik watched them ride away into the wilderness, his expression sad and bereft. It was dark, and the stars were a blaze of glory overhead, when at last he rose from the rock on which he was sitting and went down towards the glow of the campfires that filled the wide valley of Mukai Ibarra. In the cool season, when the winds came off the sea, in the months before the feast of Ramadan, the army of Al-Malik lay before Muscat and watched the Ottoman and the host of tribes loyal to the caliph come out in battle array to meet them. Al-Malik sat with his staff under a leather awning on a promontory that jutted out into the plain, his own army drawn up beneath him. He raised the long brass telescope to his eye and studied the formations of the enemy as they evolved before him. The Turks were in the centre, their cavalry squadrons in the van, and their camel men behind them.
"How many?"
he asked the men around him, who argued as though they were counting goats at a market.
12,000 Turks, they decided at last.
The centre glittered with bronze and steel. The green banners of the Sublime Porte waved and flapped in the sea breeze. The cavalry squadrons cantered forward, then settled into a solid phalanx, ready to advance to the attack.
"And the Massakara?"
the prince asked.
"How many?"
They were on the right flank, a milling throng of camel men, restless as a flock of starlings.
6,000, 7,000,
said a sheikh of the Harasis.
"At least that many," said another, "perhaps more."
Al-Malik looked to the other flank of the enemy, where the black veils and headdresses marked them as the Bani Bu Hassan and the Hart. They were the wolves of the desert, and there were as many of them as there were of the Massakara. Al-Malik tasted once again the bitter gall of disappointment in the back of his throat. They were outnumbered almost 2-1. Al-Salil had failed in his attempt to bring over the northern tribes. Al-Malik had heard nothing of him since he had vanished into the desert almost 2 moons ago. He knew in his heart that they had miscalculated, that he should never have sent Al-Salil to them. Every day he had dreaded receiving a gift from the Massakara, the severed head of his red-haired son in a leather bag. Although the grisly trophy had not arrived, the proof of his failure was out on the plain, almost 15,000 rebel lancers drawn up against him. Suddenly there was a disturbance along the centre of the Turkish line. Dispatch riders galloped forward with orders from the Ottoman staff, and the horns sounded the advance. The Turkish cavalry moved forward, rank upon rank, rippling with sunlight off their accoutrements, but the Arab formations on the flanks held their positions and allowed gaps to open in the front. This was unusual, and through his telescope the prince watched with a sudden keener interest. There was another commotion among the enemy, and this time the staff gallopers sped out from the Turkish command in the centre, waving their arms, clearly urging their Arab allies to join in the general advance and close the dangerous gaps in the front. Then at last the Arab formations began to move, but they wheeled right and left towards the centre, where the Turks stood uncertainly, confused by this unexpected evolution.
"In the sweet name of God," whispered Al-Malik, and he felt his heart swell so that his breath came short.
In the centre of the front rank of the Massakara he saw a strange new banner unfurl, carried by a tall rider on a honey-coloured thoroughbred camel. He turned his glass upon this warrior and saw that the banner was Asia Blue, shot through with gleaming silver script, and as he stared in wonder, the rider threw off his headdress and couched his lance. His hair was red gold, and his lance was aimed at the Turkish flank.
"Allah! All praise to Allah! Al-Salil has done it! He has turned the rebel tribes to our cause."
As he stared in wonder, the Arab formations on either flank of the Turks started forward, catching the Ottoman in enfilade, closing upon them like a fist of steel. The prince roused himself, gave the order,
"Advance! Charge at them!"
The war drums boomed and the horns sounded an urgent, strident note. With the Tsar and the Awamir in the centre, the army of the south rolled forward, raising a towering cloud of dust to sully the high blue sky. Dorian rode in the centre of the line, and his heart was singing. Right up to this last moment he had not been certain that the sheikhs of the Massakara would hold true to their undertaking to turn upon the Ottoman. The fleet beast under him pulled ahead of the riders on each side of him, and only Batulla could match him, riding hard a lance length behind. Ahead the Turks were in confusion, most still looking down the valley to where Prince Al-Malik's army was rolling forward. Only those closest to the right flank had seen the danger and were turning to meet the charge. With a clash and shock of body to body and shield to shield, they struck the Ottoman flank and ripped through it. Dorian selected a man from the ranks, bulky in his chainmail and bronze helmet, dark face contorted with rage and dismay as he struggled to control his plunging steed. Dorian dropped the tip of his lance and leaned low in the saddle. Under Batula's training, he had learned to pick a thrown desert melon out of the air at full gallop. Now he aimed for the opening in the Turk's chainmail shirt into his left armpit. The lance jolted in his hand as the tip found the opening unerringly and slipped through the man's chest until it struck the chainmail on the far side. Then the impact lifted the Turk clean out of the saddle, and he hung on the supple lance, kicking. Dorian dropped the tip and let him slide off the steel and roll in the dust. Then he raised the lance again and picked out his next victim. This time the lance shattered in his hand at the force of the blow, but the steel head was firmly lodged in the throat of the man he had hit. The Turk gripped the stump with both hands and tried to pluck it out of his flesh, but he died before he could do so, then slipped down from the saddle to be dragged away by his fear-crazed horse. Batula tossed the spare lance to Dorian, who caught it neatly, and in the same movement couched the long shaft and dropped its bright head to the level of the next man's belly. In the first few minutes of the charge, the ranks of the Ottoman were ripped wide open, charged from both flanks, and while they still reeled, the main army of the south crashed into their disordered front. The locked armies revolved like a mass of debris caught up in the vortex of a whirlpool, and the uproar was deafening as men hacked and shoved, shouted, and died. It could not last long, for the conflict was one-sided, and the fury of the attackers too fierce. Caught in flank and front, outnumbered at every point, the Ottoman line bulged and began to give. The Arabs sensed the victory and pressed forward, like wolves around a dying camel, tearing, howling, ripping into them, until at last they broke, and the battle turned into a bloody, broken shambles. Dorian's first charge had carried him deep into the mass of the enemy, and for a desperate while he and Batula were cut off and surrounded. The second lance broke in his hands, so he drew out his sword and fought until his right arm was daubed with Turkish blood to the shoulder. Then, abruptly, the fury of the enemy around him abated, and they broke away, turning the heads of their mounts towards the rear. Dorian saw men throw down their weapons as the Arabs came racing through the gaps in their front. The Turks whipped their mounts into a gallop and fled. "Full chase!" Dorian yelled. "Chase them! Cut them down!" Mingled like oil and water, the two armies streamed back across the plain together. The Arabs were ululating and swinging their bloody swords, shouting their war cries as the battle turned into a rout, and the fleeing Turks made little effort to defend themselves. Some threw themselves from their horses and knelt in the path of the attackers, begging for mercy. But the Arabs lanced them casually as they rode by, then wheeled back to strip the corpses of gold and booty. Dorian fought his way through to the rear. Ahead he saw that the Ottoman staff had long ago abandoned the battle, and were also in desperate flight across the plain. The general and every one of his officers had grabbed a horse or a camel and were fleeing back towards the city. In all this multitude, there was only one man Dorian wanted. "Where is Zayn al-Din?" he shouted to Batula. Dorian had seen him earlier that morning as the army had debauched through the gates of Muscat. Zayn al-Din had been with the Turkish staff, riding behind the Ottoman general, wearing half-armour and carrying a lance as though he were eager for the fight. With him had been Abu Bakr, his old crony and henchman from the Zenana at Lamu. Abu Bakr had grown tall and lean, with long moustaches, and he also was dressed in the accoutrement of a warrior. Although his two old enemies had ridden within two lance lengths of Dorian, neither had recognised him among the ranks of the Masakara, for Dorian had been mounted on a strange camel, and his face and red hair had been swathed in the folds of a black turban. "Where is he?" he shouted to Batula. "Can you see him?" He jumped up and stood tall on the wooden saddle frame of the running camel, a careless feat of skill. and from the height he scoured the open plain ahead, which was covered not only with the fleeing enemy, but also with bolting loose horses and unmounted camels whose riders had been hacked down.
"There he is!"
Dorian shouted, dropped back easily into the saddle and urged his mount forward. Zayn al-Din was half a mile ahead, mounted on the same bay stallion that Dorian had seen that morning. His plump body was unmistakable, as was the golden head rope around his blue headdress. Dorian pushed his camel to the top of its speed. He overhauled and passed many other Turks, some high-ranking officers, but he ignored them, and like a cheetah coursing the gazelle of his choice, bore down swiftly on Zayn al-Din.
"Brother!" he called to him as he ran close behind the bay stallion. "Stay a while. I have something for you."
Zayn looked back over his shoulder. The wind plucked off his headdress, and his long dark hair and his beard fluttered. Terror turned his face the colour of rancid camel butter as he saw Dorian close behind him, saw the long curved sword in his hand, his face all speckled with other men's blood, his grin savage and merciless. Zayn al-Din seemed paralysed with fear, clinging to the pommel of his saddle, his eyes fixed on Dorian as he came alongside and raised the scimitar on high. Then, with a shriek, Zayn released his grip and fell out of the saddle. He struck the hard ground and rolled like a boulder down a steep hillside until he lay still at last in a dusty heap, like a pile of old clothing. Dorian wheeled his camel and stood over him as Zayn crawled up onto his knees. His face was white with dust, and there was a raw graze down one cheek. He looked up at Dorian and began to blubber.
"Spare me, al-Salil. I will give you anything."
"Throw me your lance," Dorian called to Batula, without taking his eyes off Zayn's abject face. Batula tossed it across to him. Dorian lowered the point and placed it on Zayn's chest. Zayn began to weep, and the tears cut runnels through the dust that powdered his face.
"I have a lakh of gold rupees, my brother. It is all yours if you spare me, I swear it."
His mouth was slack, and his lips quivered and drooled with fear. "Do you remember Hassan at the Pass of the Bright Gazelle?" Dorian asked grimly, leaning out from the saddle to stare into his face.
"God forgive me," Zayn cried. "It was in the heat of the fighting. I was not myself. Forgive me, my brother."
"I wish only that I could bring myself to touch you. Then surely I would cut out your testicles, as you did to my friend. But rather would I touch a poisonous snake." Dorian spat with disgust. "You do not deserve the warrior's death by the steel of the lance, but because I am a compassionate man, I shall give it to you." He pressed forward with the long shaft, and the bright point pricked Zayn al-Din's fat chest. Then Zayn saved his own life. He found the only words that could avert Dorian's implacable wrath.
"In the name of the man who is our father, in the love of Al-Malik, grant me mercy."
Dorian's expression changed. His gaze wavered, and he withdrew the lance tip an inch. "You ask for the judgment of the father you have betrayed? We both know it must be the garrote of the executioner. If that is the death you choose, over the clean death I offer you, so be it then. I grant it to you." Dorian put up the lance and rammed the butt down into the leather bucket behind his heel.
"Batula!"
he called, and when his lance-bearer came up, he ordered him, "Bind the arms of this eater of swine flesh behind his back and place a noose around his neck." Batula slipped down from the saddle and swiftly trussed Zayn's arms, then dropped a running noose over his head. He passed the end of the rope up to Dorian, who made it fast to one of the loops on his saddle.
"On your feet!"
Dorian barked, and gave the rope a yank. "I am taking you to the prince." Zayn lurched upright, then staggered after Dorian's camel. Once he lost his balance and rolled on the ground, but Dorian did not slacken the pace or even look back, and Zayn struggled up again, his robe ripped and his knees bloody. Before they had covered a mile of that sanguinary plain, on which the corpses of the Turks lay like seaweed on a storm-lashed beach, the golden sandals had been torn from Zayn's feet, and his soles were raw. His face was swollen and black as the rope half choked him, and he was so weak he could no longer call for mercy. As Prince Abd Muhammad al-Malik rode up to the gates of Muscat at the head of his retinue, the citizens of the city and the courtiers of the Caliph al-Uzzah ibn Yaqub threw open the gates and came out to greet him. They had torn their garments and poured ash and dust over their heads as a sign of repentance, and they knelt in front of his horse, pleading for their lives, swearing allegiance to him and hailing him as the new Caliph of Oman. The prince sat impassively on his horse, a noble magisterial figure, but when the vizier of his brother Yaqub came forward, bearing a stained sack over his shoulder, al-Malik's expression turned to sorrow, for he knew what it contained. The vizier emptied the sack into the dust of the roadway, and Yaqub's severed head rolled to the feet of the prince's mount and stared up at him with dull, glazed eyes. His grey beard was matted and filthy, like that of a street beggar, and the flies settled in a humming cloud on his open eyes and bloody lips. Al-Malik gazed down on him sadly, then looked up at the vizier and spoke softly. "You seek to win my approval by murdering my brother and bringing me this sad, broken thing?" he asked. "Great Lord, I did only what I thought would please you." The vizier blanched and trembled. The prince gestured to the sheikh of the Awamir at his side. "Kill him!" The sheikh leaned from the saddle and, with his sword, split the vizier's skull down to the chin. "Treat my brother's remains with all respect, and prepare him for burial before the setting of the sun. I shall lead the prayers for his soul," said al-Malik. Then he looked at the cringing citizens of Muscat. "Your city is now my city. Its people are now my people," he told them. "By my royal decree, Muscat is exempt from plunder. Its women are protected by my word of honour from rape and its treasure from pillage." He lifted his right hand in blessing and said, "After you have sworn the oath of fealty, all your trespasses and crimes against me shall be forgiven and forgotten." Then he rode on into the city, to the halls of Muscat, and took his place upon the elephant throne of Oman, carved from great ivory tusks. 100 noblemen clamoured for the new caliph's ear, and 100 pressing affairs of state awaited his attention. But one of the first men for whom he sent was Sheikh al-Salil. When Dorian prostrated himself before the throne, al-Malik stepped down, lifted him to his feet, and embraced him. "I had thought you dead, my son. Then when I saw your banner flying in the ranks of the Masakara, my heart shouted aloud with joy. I owe you much. I shall never know just how much, for if you had not brought in the northern tribes under my flag, the battle might have gone hard for us. Perhaps I might not be sitting on the elephant throne this day. Father, during the battle I took a prisoner from the army of the Ottoman," Dorian told him, and made a sign to Batula, who waited among the noblemen at the back of the throne room. He came forward, leading Zayn al-Din on the rope. Zayn's attire was ragged and filthy with dust and dried blood, his hair and beard white with dust, and his bare feet raw and bloodied like those of a pilgrim. At first al-Malik did not recognize him. Then Zayn stumbled forward and threw himself at his father's feet, and wept and wriggled his whole body like a whipped dog. "Father, forgive me, forgive my stupidity. I am guilty of treason and disrespect. I am guilty of greed. I was led astray by evil men." "How is this so?" the caliph asked coldly. "The Sublime Porte offered me the elephant throne if I would turn against you, and I was weak and stupid. I regret this with all my heart, and if you should order me killed, I will shout my love for you to the heavens as the life flies from my body."
"You richly deserve such a death," the caliph said. "You have had nothing but love and kindness from me all your life, and you have repaid me with treachery and dishonour."
"Allow me another chance to prove my love to you," Zayn slobbered on his father's sandals, and mucus streamed from his nose as the tears poured from his eyes.
"This glad day has already been marred by the death of my brother, Yaqub. There has been enough blood spilled," said al-Malik thoughtfully. "Stand up, Zayn al-Din.
I grant you pardon, but in penance you must make the pilgrimage to the holy places at Mecca and ask forgiveness there also. Do not show me your face again until you return with your soul cleansed."
Zayn lumbered to his feet.
"All Allah's blessing upon you, Majesty, for your benevolence and your compassion. You shall find my love to be like a mighty river that flows on eternally."
Still grovelling, bowing, and mouthing protestations of loyalty and duty, Zayn backed away down the length of the throne room, then turned and pushed his way through the crowds and out of the tall carved ivory doors.
10 days after the triumphal entry into Muscat, and a week before the commencement of Ramadan, the coronation of the new caliph was celebrated in the halls of Muscat and the streets of the city. Most of the tribal warriors had drifted back into the wilderness to their villages around the tiny oases scattered down the length of Oman. For they were desert dwellers and unhappy behind the walls of a city. They swore their oaths of fealty to Al-Malik, then rode away on their camels laden with the spoils of the Ottoman army that they had destroyed. Those who remained joined the celebrations in the streets of the city, where whole carcasses of camels and sheep were roasted on the bonfires in every souk and square. The ram's horns sounded, the drums beat, and men danced in the street while veiled women watched from the upper floors of the huddled buildings. The new caliph walked in procession through the crowded streets, stopping every few paces to embrace one of the warriors who had fought in his army. The crowds ululated, fired joy shots in the air, and fell at his feet. It was well after midnight when the caliph returned to the palace of Muscat, and Sheikh al-Salil was still at his side, where he had been all that day.
"Stay with me yet a while," the caliph ordered, when they reached the door of his bedchamber.
He took Dorian's arm and led him through and out onto the high balcony which overlooked the sea and the streets of the city. The music and the shouts of the revellers carried faintly up to them, and the flames of the bonfires reflected off the walls and lit the dancers.
"I owe you an explanation for pardoning Zayn al-Din," said the caliph at last.
"You owe me nothing, Majesty," Dorian protested. "It is I who owe you everything."
"Zayn deserved a harsher punishment. He was a traitor, and I know how he treated your comrades at the Pass of the Bright Gazelle."
"My concerns are nothing," Dorian replied. "It is what he did to you, and what he will one day do to you again, that angers me."
"You think that his repentance was a sham?"
"He lusts for the elephant throne," said Dorian. "I would have been happier if you had taken a scorpion into your bosom and a cobra into your bed."
The caliph sighed sadly.
"He is my eldest son. I could not begin my reign with his murder. But I have placed you in great jeopardy, for his hatred of you is implacable."
"I am able to defend myself, father."
"That you have proved," the caliph laughed softly. "But now, two other matters. I have another task for you, a dangerous and difficult one."
"You have only to command me, Majesty."
"Our trade with the African interior is most important to the prosperity of our people. We, who once were only poor desert nomads, are becoming a nation of seafarers and traders."
"I understand that, father.
Today I received a messenger from the Sultan of Zanzibar. Our African trade is under a new and grave threat. The very existence of our bases at Zanzibar and Lamu is at stake."
"How is this possible?"
"A band of marauders is savaging our caravan routes between the Fever Coast and the Great Lakes. Our African trade is in jeopardy."
"Are the black tribes rising in rebellion?" Dorian asked.
"Perhaps this is the case. We know that there are black tribesmen among the marauders, but there are also rumours that they are led by infidel Franks."
"From which country?" Dorian asked.
The caliph shrugged.
"This is not known. All that is certain is that they are ruthless in their attacks upon our slave caravans. We have lost almost the entire year's revenue from the sale of slaves, together with immense quantities of ivory and gold out of the interior."
"What do you want me to do?" Dorian asked.
"I will give you a firman of authority, a commission as a general in my armies, and as many fighting men as you need. 1,000, 2,000. I want you to sail south to Lamu, then cross the channel and march inland to put an end to these depredations."
"When do you wish me to leave?"
"You must sail with the new moon that ends the fast of Ramadan."
The flotilla of Sheikh al-Salil, the drawn sword, anchored off the beach of the island of Lamu in the full of the moon. It comprised 7 large sea-going dhows carrying 1,200 troops of the caliphate. Dorian went ashore in the dawn to call upon the governor, to present his firman and to make arrangements for the reception and resupply of his army. He needed quarters for his men ashore to recuperate from the long voyage down the coast and supplies of fresh food, horses and baggage animals. The camels of the desert would not survive long in the humid, pestilent coast, and neither would Arabian horses from the north. Dorian needed animals that had been reared on the coast and had developed an immunity to the African diseases. It took 3 days to get all his men and his baggage train ashore, and Dorian spent much of this time at the landing or in the newly built camp above the beach. On the evening of the 3rd day, he was walking back through the streets of the town, accompanied by Batula and 3 of his captains. They were almost at the gates of the fort when he heard his childhood name called, "Al-Abkharab!" He spun round, for he recognised the voice, though he had not heard it in many years, and stared at the heavily veiled woman who crouched in the doorway of the old mosque across the narrow lane.
"Tahi? Is that you, old mother? Praise be to God, my child. I thought you might not remember me."
Dorian wanted to rush to her and embrace her, but it would be a grave breach of decorum and etiquette to do so in a public place.
"Stay there, and I will send someone to bring you to my quarters," he told her, and walked on.
He sent Batula back to bring her through the gates of the fort to the wing that the governor had placed at his disposal. As soon as Tahi stepped through the door, she threw back her veil and rushed to him. She was weeping almost incoherently.
"My little boy, my baby, how tall you have grown! The beard and the fierce eyes, like a falcon! But I would have known you anywhere. What a great man you have become, and a sheikh also!"
Dorian laughed, held her, and stroked her hair. "What is this silver I see here, O mother? But you are still beautiful.
I am an old woman, but your embrace makes me young again.
Sit down." He led her to the pile of rugs on the terrace, then sent a slave for sherbet and a platter of honeyed dates.
"There is so much I want to hear from you."
She reached across to stroke his beard and his cheek.
"My beautiful baby, who has become a beautiful man, tell me everything you have done since you left Lamu."
"That would take a day and a night," he protested, smiling fondly at the old woman.
"I have the rest of my life to listen," she said.
So he answered all her questions, in the meantime holding back his own, although it took all his restraint. At last he came to the end of the recital. "And thus the caliph has sent me back to Lamu and the Fever Coast, and I praise God that he has, for now, I am able to look on your beloved face again." Her face was deeply lined with care and hardship, and her hair steely grey, but he loved her as much as he ever had.
"Tell me, how have you fared since I went away?"
She told him how she had stayed on in the Zenana, given menial duties by the head eunuch Kush.
"At least I have had shelter and food in my mouth. For that I praise God's name."
"You shall come to live with me now," he promised her, "and I shall be able to repay all the love and kindness that you lavished upon me." She wept again with happiness. Then, trying to make it sound casual, he asked the question and waited for the answer he dreaded.
"What news of little Yasmini?
She must be a woman by now, and long ago have been sent to India to marry her Mughal princeling."
"He died of the cholera before she could go to him," Tahi said, and watched his face shrewdly.
He tried to disguise his feelings from her, and sipped at the cup of sherbet.
"So they found another noble and important husband for her?"
he asked softly.
"Yes,"
Tahi agreed.
"The emir of the Al Bilkail in Abu Dhabi. a rich old man with 50 concubines, but only 3 wives, the eldest having died 2 years ago. She saw the hurt and resignation in his green eyes. "When was she married?" he asked. She had to take pity on him. "She is betrothed, but not yet married. She will sail to meet her bridegroom when the winds change and the kuzi blows again. In the meantime, she waits sadly in the zenana here on Lamu."
"Yasmini is still here on Lamu?"
He stared at her.
"I did not know.
I was with her in the garden by the fountain this morning. She knows you are here. Everyone in the zenana knows it. You should have seen Yasmini's eyes when she spoke your name. They glowed like the stars of the Great Cross. She said, 'I love Al-Amkhara as a brother and more. I must see him one last time before I become an old man's bride and disappear from the world forever.'"
Dorian jumped up from the rug and strode to the end of the terrace. He stood there, gazing over the bay where his dhows rode at anchor. He felt a strange sense of elation, as though the wheel of his destiny had made another turn. During the hard years in the desert, his memories of Yasmini had grown dim, but he had refused the offers of the sheikhs of the Saar to find him a wife from among their own daughters. He had not known until now that he had been waiting for something or someone else, for the memory of the little monkey-faced girl with the mischievous smile. Then he felt a touch of dismay. There was so much that stood in their way. She was imprisoned in the zenana and betrothed to another man. In the eyes of Allah, she was his sister, and he knew that the penalty for incest was a hideous death. If he violated a royal virgin and defiled the sanctity of the zenana, even the caliph could not save him from death by stoning or decapitation. And what would they do to Yasmini? He shuddered as he remembered the tales, repeated in whispers, of Kush's treatment of any of his charges who strayed. They said that one girl had taken 4 days to die, and that her screams had prevented anyone in the zenana from sleeping during all that harrowing time. "I cannot let her take the risk," he said aloud, and hugged shoulders torn by emotions that swung him first one way, then the other. "And yet I cannot resist my heart's urging." He turned and smashed his bunched fist into the wall of rough coral and revelled in the pain. "What shall I do?" He strode back to where Tahi squatted patiently on the rug. "Will you take a message back to her?"
"You know I will. What shall I tell her, my son?"
"Tell her that at moonrise tonight I will be waiting at the end of the Angel's Road." He would not let Batula accompany him, but at nightfall he took a horse and, heavily robed and veiled, rode out of the town towards the north. He remembered every track, stream, clump of forest and stretch of mangrove swamp. He circled back through the palm groves and saw the walls of the zenana ahead, tall, massive and dark before the moonrise. He found the old ruin and tethered his mare in a patch of bush nearby, where she would be hidden from anyone using the woodcutter's track. He did not expect any islander to be abroad at this hour, for they were superstitious and terrified of the forest djinns. He climbed over the piles of fallen masonry and pushed his way through the thicket of bush and scrub until he stepped down into the hidden saucer in the centre. The entrance to the tunnel was overgrown, and he could see that no one had used it in all the years that had passed. He found a seat on a block of coral, where he could watch both the entrance to the tunnel and keep an eye open for intruders. He did not have long to wait, for soon the moon glow filled the eastern sky, and then as it rose above the tops of the palms, it struck down into the saucer with a silver light. He heard a soft sound, light footsteps, and a whisper from the entrance of the tunnel. "Dawi, are you there?" Her voice was more husky than he remembered, and goose pimples rose along his forearms, stirred the fine hairs at the back of his neck. "I am here, Yasi,"